God, but if I'm praying the act of this to the Mother of God,
yeah,
then it's like if anyone's been in any sort of singing sort of a thing, there's a specific note for A,
yeah.
And I can think that I can hit A, but then when you hit A, then I bring myself up or down, right?
Right.
And so that's what the prayers are. They're the perfect pitch,
right?
And they draw us into the harmony with the will of the Father, and we
right.
can know.
Right.
Then I can know, because I can think I know what's best for me, my child, my husband, the mayonnaise. But I find out through the prayers that have been passed down, and so they've been affirmed.
Right.
Every generation, the priests, the bishops, the people.
Yeah.
And then I can come along, and I have to submit myself and harmonize.
Right.
It is, like it changes your soul and your pattern of thinking. And then in those times when you can't remember a prayer, but you've been praying them and been in liturgy, and now what comes out when you pray your own words?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You start to think, how have I... And so
absolutely.
You do that, and it's so much better.
Yeah, and I think especially over time, over a long time of praying those prayers, even if you didn't... like, let's say you're praying on your own, even if you can't quite remember how it's phrased or something, it doesn't really matter, because the spirit of it you can remember. Like that humble spirit of... Lord, we come before you with absolute sinfulness and unable to do anything ourselves, but we beseech you of your loving kindness, for you are the lover of mankind. You know, like this kind of way of looking at our relationship with God as perfectly loving and us totally undeserving, but, you know, and even very subtle things in that are conveyed by those prayers that then become really the content of our prayer. And you're I think, exactly... That's why we don't only rely on our own words, because our passions, we can end up praying our passions. That's a good way to put it.
My children's prayers changed within a few months of us coming.
Yeah.
I could tell a difference when we would have a prayer time right. in the morning. And before we started doing the trisecond in the morning,
yeah.
their prayers just changed. Like they began to try and... It's like when you follow a writer and
yeah.
then you start to write something and you begin to write in their same... You know, way
yeah.
of thinking.
Sure.
Like
well, children are really sponges, and
yes.
so they're likely to change more quickly than
mm-hmm.
us when we're older.
Which is why we should become childlike.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, let's shift a little bit now. And so last time, in the second half of the class, we were talking about the Theotokos, the Mariology of the Church, how we understand the Mother of God. And of course, we talked about how everything we say about her, and in particular the term Theotokos, is Christological. It has to do with our understanding of Christ. Then we went through all the different images in the Old Testament of the Mother of God. And so now, the next section is considering several of her... other titles, in addition to Theotokos, how we speak of her. We, in addition to calling her Theotokos, we speak of her as the ever-virgin Mary. And we said last time that that's represented in icons of her, where there are three stars, one on each shoulder and one on her veil, which represent her being virgin before birth, during birth, after birth. That throughout her giving of birth, she remained completely pure and chaste and virginal. And this is important for our theology, actually, because it's like Christ is restoring us through baptism to an original creation, like Adam. St. Maximus the Confessor says that... you know, that in our birth, we're inheriting this fallen humanity. So we need a fresh start. And just like Adam was taken from the virgin earth, Christ is taken from a virgin womb. So it's like he reestablishes humanity, gives us a fresh start. And when we're baptized into that. So we have this strong sense of the importance of the ever-virginity of the Theotokos. And there's this idea, of course, that people have that, well, didn't Jesus have brothers and sisters? But of course, according to our tradition, those siblings of his were in fact step-siblings, because Joseph had been previously married, and you know, as we know, he was betrothed to the Virgin Mary, but he had children from his marriage to Salome. So we know he was married to Salome. We know that they had four sons: James, Jude, Joseph, and Simon. And by tradition, three of the brothers didn't want to share their part of the inheritance with Christ, but James did, and he split his with him, and that's why he's able to say brother of the Lord, and Jude doesn't claim that title in his epistle. He says, I'm the brother of James. Yeah, because he was, because of his, he was ashamed.
So he had repented.
Yeah, he had repented, absolutely. He's an apostle, but he was ashamed of not having received him in their youth, you know. And when he was younger, before he became a disciple, so he said, I'm not worthy of claiming him as my brother. Yes, ma'am.
I've read recently that Joseph was about 90 years old whenever he was betrothed to the Theotokos, and that she could have been as young as 12.
She could have been as young as 12, yeah, that's right. And according to some accounts, she was 12 or 13 or 14.
But he was specifically in several different places I read that he was 90.
Okay, well, and I've read different places, different ages, but that he was quite elderly is the tradition. Yeah, according, and that's, for example, it's found in the what's called the Proto-Evangelion of James. That's this, like, extra-biblical information about the family and the birth and all of those things that took place, that's part of our tradition, even though it's not considered scripture. Then there's the title Panagia. This is really the favorite name for the Virgin Mary of the Greek-speaking Orthodox. If you go to Greece, I mean, this is they always call her the Panagia. That's, and they even, you know, like people will talk about, you know, it's like, I don't know, like we might say, Lord have mercy or something like that. They'll say like, my Panagia, you know, like Mother of God intercede for me kind of thing. But they'll just, in a shortened way, they might just say like, my Panagia.
Is that all holy?
All, it means all holy, yeah. So the all, yeah, exactly. And this is related to like, the way we call her in the Akathist, the original Akathist to the Mother of God, we call her the... Sometimes it's translated as the holiest of saints or something like that, or the most holy saint. But another way to translate the same thing is the Holy of Holies. Why do we call her the Holy of Holies? Holiest of the saints... It's plural. But really, because in Greek, Agios is saint or holy. It's the same word. So if you say the Holy of Holies, Saint of Saints, it's the same thing in Greek. So what's the Holy of Holies?
Oh, it's the Ark, isn't it? Or the inner?
It's the inner court of the tabernacle. Exactly. Christ came to dwell in her, just like God is present in the Holy of Holies, the temple. So in the feast of the entrance of the Mother of God into the temple, all the hymnography of the church talks about that, how she entered the temple in order to become the temple. You know, that's what's emphasized. And of course, then we say, and she's the example for us because we're all supposed to become the temple that contains the uncontainable God. But she's the archetype of that. So we say, in fact, the Holy of Holies in the Old Testament was a foreshadowing of the Theotokos. That's what it's pointing to, you know. And, of course, the church being the place of the presence of God. And that, by the way, we say that the church and the Theotokos image each other. And the Theotokos, in particular, is also an image of the church. She's our mother, and she's our mother. See, both are, in a sense, our mother. So we sing, more honorable than the cherubim and more glorious beyond compare than the seraphim. So this, I'm not going to write all that down, but that's another way that we talk about her, as being more honorable than the cherubim, more glorious than the seraphim. How can we say that? What does that mean? What's the significance of that? Well, again, you know, we say, like in the church, we say that the cherubim and the seraphim stand by in awe, watching what's taking place when the gifts are consecrated and God in the flesh, Jesus Christ, becomes present there. And then they see us partaking of that, and they don't do that. And they're in awe that we do that. The angels are in awe of what's taking, that what we participate in. Well, in the same way, I mean, they're in awe of what takes place within her, that God comes in the flesh and is born of her. And there's this, in Psalm 8, it says that God created us a little lower than the angels, right? But what happens when Christ becomes incarnate? He becomes a human being, and then he does everything that he does, and he dies, and he rises from the dead, and he ascends into heaven. And where is he seated? The right hand of God. And does he still have his human flesh? Is he still human? Yes. So our humanity is seated at the right hand of God. So it's more honorable than the cherubim and more glorious beyond compare than the seraphim. So in fact, that's a way of speaking of her as the exemplar of our humanity, of our race. But we see it in her in a special way. That raising up of our humanity to something, really what it was intended by God to be in the first place, but which it fell from, right? We talk about her as being we say that she's without corruption. If you notice in that more honorable than the cherubim hymn, "Thou who without corruption didst bear God the Word." Some translations are different. Some, like I think in the Little Red Prayer Book, it says "without stain." Mm-hmm. That's, I think in the, if I remember right, in the Arabic, it's something more like that. And so that's how you get that that translation. But in the Greek, it's very clearly corruption. And corruption is specifically, it's not talking about like sin per se in that instance, but what it's talking about is a physical change. Because corruption, really, like the meaning of the word itself is a change that takes place. And again, this is a reference to her ever virginity. And so it's not saying that you know, that it's not making a claim about the sexual act. It's just saying that she's a virgin without change. You gave birth, right? Thou who without corruption didst give birth to God the Word. That's the point, is that as ever virgin, she gave birth. You have a question, Anna?
Well, in the icon of Christ, it shows, I mean, he was born like, he apparently was just like any other baby was born. You know, he was covered with blood, because it shows in the icon the washing. Women washing him.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a miracle in itself. I mean, that she's still a virgin. But
well, he was within the womb.
Right. And yeah. That's what I'm saying. He appeared, I mean, that's what he appeared, even though nothing was changed with her.
Yeah. And this is, you know, in my opinion, I don't think we need to examine this mystery too closely.
Yeah.
But it's simply the tradition of the church that the birth took place in a miraculous way that preserved her virginity throughout. Also, as I said, you know, this isn't specifically saying something about the sexual act per se, although it is true that it's through sexual procreation that the stain of sin is passed on from generation to generation. You know, that the illness is passed on.
We're not guilty of Adam's sin. We just
not guilty. It's a sickness that's like a hereditary sickness that's passed on from generation to generation.
Well, that was passed on from the Theotokos to him, right?
Well, he receives our humanity, right. Everything it is to be human, right. But in receiving our humanity, he simultaneously heals it.
Well, his seed came from God. His seed didn't come from Adam.
Exactly.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, I have a father.
So the idea is that his birth is not like our birth because it's establishing a new birth. He inherits humanity,
right.
But the illness is put to an end in his receiving it. Mm-hmm. So this is important because it's not just on the cross that the change begins, but it's in his incarnation itself that the change begins. And the cross is the culmination of that. It's still necessary because that is God's ultimate act of love for us. You know, it's his ultimate expression of love, and it destroys death. He recreates birth in his birth, and he transforms death in his death. Does that make sense? So he gives us a new start, and then he transforms death into from an end into a beginning. It becomes the gateway into eternal life. So it's all necessary. It's not just like, well, he just happened to be born and then what really matters is the cross, right? It's like every moment, every step along the way is significant for our salvation. His birth, his baptism, his, you know, meeting of the Lord in the temple, and every single moment, his transfiguration, his ascension. It's changing the water into wine. It's like there's no detail in the gospel that's just incidental, like, what the heck? It could have been like this or like that. No, everything means something for us, for our salvation. So we say that she's without personal sin, that she does not break communion with God at any point in her life. What she says when the Archangel Gabriel comes to her and announces that she will give birth to the Messiah is yes. Now, she doesn't understand how it can be. Rationally, she cannot comprehend, but her heart's immediate response is one of humility and obedience. Yes, thy will be done. Be it to me according to thy word. And so our tradition is that she says, be it to me according to thy word, throughout her life. And there's never a time when she says otherwise. But she does, I don't have to write it, but she does inherit our broken, sinful state, the disease, the illness. She inherits it, and Christ must heal it in her. So she's not born immaculately. We disagree with the Roman Catholic teaching that says that there's an immaculate conception in which God changes her within the womb of her mother so that she's born without the taint of sin. No, she's born with our sinful, broken humanity. But that comes to an end when she gives birth to Christ and he heals our humanity in himself.
Immaculate conception as a doctrine, that came later.
So
it's not part of when the church was united.
No. It developed over time, and it was expressed as an opinion by different people over time. I don't know when it first appeared, but it appeared long before it became a dogma in the Roman Catholic Church. I don't remember what year it was when it first appeared. But over time, it sort of became more popular. More people in the West were expressing that, and then eventually, but not until the 19th century, middle of the 19th century, the First Vatican Council became a dogma of the Roman Catholic Church. Dogma meaning you have to believe it in order to be saved. That's how they understand dogma. And the infallibility of the Pope is also a dogma that you have to believe in order to be saved, according to the First Vatican Council. So we definitely disagree with that, and that teaching is related to the idea of original sin as something that involves guilt that's passed on from generation to generation. So the problem, the theological problem that the Immaculate Conception was supposed to be solving, was that if she inherited the guilt, then she would have passed the guilt on to her son, and he would have been born guilty. According to that Augustinian understanding of original sin, you end up with that problem. Therefore, God must have done something so that she didn't inherit the guilt, so that her son doesn't inherit the guilt. You see? It's like mental gymnastics. But for us, we never understood the ancestral sin as guilt, but simply as this broken humanity that's passed on from generation to generation that Christ heals. There's no guilt involved, right? So there's no problem with Christ being guilty of something. I already said she's the mother of all the faithful. She acts as an intercessor. We ask for her prayers. We ask for the prayers of all the saints, just like we ask for one another's prayers. We simply say that her prayers are very, very effective, because prayers of a righteous man avail much, and there's no more righteous woman than the Theotokos. And she's the protectress of Christians, we call her. And she's an archetype of mankind. These are all different ways, and there are many more that we talk about her. So she's an example for us in her total surrender to the will of God, in her concern for others, which we see in John chapter 2 at the wedding in Cana when they run out of wine. And so she cares about... She's so tender, you know? Like, she cares... Their celebration, you know, it can't continue if they don't have wine. So she comes to her son, "You have to do something." He says, "It's not yet my time." But he obeys her anyway. Even though he says, "It's not yet my time," he obeys her, and that's his first miracle, according to John's Gospel. He worked his first miracle in response to his mom. He does it. So
he was keeping the fifth commandment, too.
He was in obedience to his mother, absolutely. Honor your father and mother. So, and he does both, right? He honors his father and he honors his mother. Yeah. Perfect union of man with God, we see in her. That this is, again, she's the temple, she's the place where that union takes place within her. And this is an image of our life, how we are to become. We want to have that perfect union of God and man within us. She's a prototype, an exemplar for virgins and mothers throughout history and of the church. And there's that beautiful icon that we don't have. Well, this one's kind of like it. It's the Virgin enthroned. But the one above the altar, if you look in the altar and you see the holy table, and up above, it's called the More Spacious Than the Heavens, Platitera, more spacious, which shows her as the church, you know, containing Christ. He's present there, and written around it are the words from Isaiah that say, a sign shall be given, you know. The Lord says, ask to Isaiah, ask a sign, and he doesn't want to ask for it. He said, I'm going to give you a sign anyway. A virgin shall conceive and give birth, and his name shall be called Emmanuel, God with us. So it's this idea that through her, God is with us. And in the church, God is with us. So she's an image of that. The feasts of the Mother of God. What's the first one in the church year? So the church year begins September 1st. So what's the first feast of the Mother of God? It's the nativity of the Mother of God. So we celebrate her nativity. September 8th, November 21st is the presentation in the temple, which we already mentioned. When she was 3 years old, her parents Joachim and Anna brought her to the temple and presented her. And it's a miracle. It was totally out of the ordinary, but the tradition is that Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist, was the high priest at that time, and he was inspired by God to actually bring her into the Holy of Holies, right? So, again, at that feast, we sing about how she is the Holy of Holies, entering the Holy of Holies to receive training there, so that from then until she was somewhere between 12 and 14, she lived there. But now she's starting to get to be to the age for marriage, and Zachariah says, you can't live here anymore. You need to, you know, have a man whose house you enter into. And so this was arranged for her to live with Joseph, and they were betrothed. Then, of course, the Nativity of the Lord is a feast that she's very close to. And the day after, so December 26th, on many of these feasts of the Lord, on the next day, we remember the people or a person who's closest to the feast. So this is called the Synaxis, which means gathering of the Theotokos. That's the day after Christmas. Then there's the Meeting of the Lord, which is, it's a feast of the Lord, but it's also considered a feast of the Theotokos, so we use blue for that feast. By the way, blue is a traditional color for feasts of the Mother of God. And that's considered a feast of the Theotokos. Why? It's her purification, according to the law. The mother comes, even though we say, like, she doesn't need to be purified. But again, Christ doesn't need to be baptized, you know. It's the fulfillment of the law. It's the completion, the thing that the law was pointing to. So it's the 40th day, according to the law, when the mother comes and is and a sacrifice is given of the turtle doves. And she's prayed for, and the child is received. So that's the Feast of the Meeting of the Lord. Next, sorry, I didn't put the date of that. That's February 2nd, which is 40 days after Christmas. Then March, what is it? The Annunciation. What's the date?
The 25th.
Yes, which is 9 months before
December 25th.
December 25th, exactly. The Annunciation. And you know, somebody asked me about how, isn't it that, you know, we don't really know the date of the birth of Christ, but the pagans had this winter holiday where, you know, they were worshiping the sun, Saturnalia or whatever they called it. And it's close to the winter solstice, right? So you have the winter solstice, it's December 21st, and the Christians just came along and said, well, we're going to replace this with our celebration of Jesus' birth and everything like that. Yes, it's true that in the 4th century the church was aware of this pagan holiday, and we said, actually, our celebration of Christ's birth is the fulfillment of that and the replacement of that. And he's the Son of Righteousness. He's the true Son that we worship, right? So we say that in the Troparion. So there's this awareness that he's actually the fulfillment of the sort of pagan intuition to worship the Son. Yes, that's true. But also, by tradition, he really was born, or the Annunciation really took place, rather, at this time of the year, which is the Passover. It's historically, that's the time of the Passover. Mm-hmm. So there's this connection between the Passover and Pascha and Christmas and the Annunciation.
Is that when the, so this guy Joshua Gibbs I follow, he talks about that if someone were to, he kind of words it something like, you want like a ancient Motel 6 registry that
yeah.
can be easily forged.
Right.
But God said that the stars in the sky are for signs and wonders. And so you have the winter solstice, which is the darkest day of the year.
Right.
And here comes the light of the world.
Exactly.
Yeah, he's like, that's a better light. And bigger sign.
Light,
yeah.
Light, true light,
right.
True light.
So in other words, people want to say, well, the Christians were just like we're scheming or something. Like we sort of came up with this clever idea to replace this holiday with this other one, but we don't have any real reason to believe that he was born around that time or whatever. But that's exactly the point, is that God ordained it from the beginning of time that it would be celebrated at this time, that this was the time when the light came into the world. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely connected to that pagan celebration, which takes place at the darkest time of the year.
Which everybody in the world at that time, they would have, all of that would have harmonized for them.
Yeah.
Because they believed in cosmology.
Right.
You know, they didn't scientifically be skeptical about everything.
Yeah. So why wouldn't God speak to those beliefs and, you know, where people were in that by making it happen that way? And certainly, you know, he can and he does. So the Dormition is August 15th. And that's the last, this is the first great feast of the year. The Nativity of the Theotokos and her falling asleep is the last great feast of the year. So really the festal cycle of the year goes from her birth to her death. That's interesting, isn't it? And Christ's birth and crucifixion, death, burial, resurrection all fit within that. What that is a sign of the fact that the whole church year, it's not just about her birth and her death and everything in between. It's about our birth and our death and everything in between, because she's the example for us, right? So we see how the whole church year is showing us an example of what it is to be born, how to live, how to be in communion with God, and what a holy death is. And that's what we're preparing for, right? So, and we do believe, and this is very important, that she did fall asleep, that she died. And again, if you believe that she was immaculately conceived and did not have any guilt for sin, and therefore the wages of sin is death, and she doesn't have any sin, so she doesn't die. That's what happens in that understanding of the Immaculate Conception, is that she can't die because she doesn't have the wages of sin.
So they believe she was just translated?
Yeah. That's why they call it the Assumption, not the Dormition. Mm-hmm. We sometimes borrow that term, Assumption, because we do have the tradition that she was assumed, but our tradition is that she was assumed after she died. In other words, she's the first one after Christ to enter the resurrection. Her body was already taken up, but she died first. And that's very important for us, because she inherited the fallen humanity, even though she didn't choose willingly to sin, that she had no voluntary sin. That make sense? So properly we call it the Dormition because it's her falling asleep, and then she was assumed bodily into heaven. The tradition about that, of course, was Thomas, the apostle who's always running behind, came late to her funeral, and he wanted to venerate her body, and they opened up her casket, and her body was not there anymore. So just like he became the pretext for us knowing that Christ had his wounds after his resurrection, right? Which is really, that's really something. Think about that. That Christ has his wounds in his hands and his feet forever. Mm. And by the way, St. Maximus makes a point about that that is important, which is that in Christ, we have our wounds healed, and our imagination and our memory can become dispassionate, so that just like in the case of Christ, the marks of the wounds are still there, and the memory is still there, but there's no longer a passionate connection to it. It's a redeemed sort of memory of things. Because we carry wounds, right? And the memory of those wounds. And for us, if we remember something bad that happened to us, there might be a lot of passion connected to that. But it's possible for us to have that healed. And it's never like God sucks the memory out of our head, you know? No, the memory is still there, but the memory can become healed. The memory itself of the event can become transformed.
But
yes, ma'am.
If she was gone when they opened her casket, well, did they bury it there? I mean, they say she's buried at the.
It's in the Garden of Gethsemane. You can go in her tomb. So it's a cave. It's underground. It's where there's a Jewish cemetery there, like. But she's underneath, basically. She's in the ground underneath there. And so you go down all these steps. I can't remember how many there are. And you're deep down underground. And now, of course, there are like icons and, I don't know, they have like a shop there and they're selling like trinkets and whatever. It's kind of ridiculous. But you can go down And when you're down in there, especially if there are not a lot of pilgrims around, which I've been there before when it's just really quiet, I felt like it was about the most peaceful place in Jerusalem. There's tension in Jerusalem, but not there. And but she's not there.
Right.
It's just the place where she was buried.
Was. Yeah. That's what I thought.
Right. So that's why we don't have any relics from her. Only clothing, like the belt. You know, there's a famous sash or belt of the Theotokos that has been handed down, and there are pieces of it in different places. And so we have things like that, what we call secondary relics, but we don't have her body like other saints. Yeah. So it's probably enough for today. It's a lot. Any questions? If not, then